Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Sunday, March the 8th. And as we like to do on Sundays, we'll be chatting with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. At least we know it's going to be Vice President Biden versus Sanders. Well, we think we know that. There's an interesting story by Michael Goodwin that we're going to talk about that may change the story a little bit. We'll talk about Jane Fonda. We'll talk about a lot of different people, the virus, another great day in the American economy on Friday. So let's get it going. Let's say hello to our friend Bill Katz up in New York. Bill, how's the weather?
It's a very funny thing. I didn't go out today, so I can only look through a window. I don't want to get too close to the window because the virus might get me. I don't know who was in here. Look, I'm heroic. I'm going out and I see it's actually very nice outside. Not too many people out walking because they're all barricaded in their homes against the virus.
Yes. Well, it is interesting because it is. Look, obviously, we all want to take issues like this seriously, and definitely you want to be cautious. But when you think of what has happened, we're a country of 330 million people. Probably more people were killed in traffic accidents this weekend than will ever die out of this horrible virus.
Yes. And saw the comparison between this and the flu.
You had
the
a great
ordinary
article
flu
about
is,
this.
Is killing far more people, and yet people don't get their vaccines. The sense of urgency isn't there. Look, we should take this very seriously. Of course, we shouldn't. And I think the press has been responsible in not creating a panic. But what is craved right now is information, and that is that apparently this is a virus that is not as serious as the flu, not as intense, does not kill anywhere near as number of people per 100,000 as the flu does. They're looking for a vaccine, and they're asking people to take reasonable precautions. But I know that there are some medical people who have who really are scoffing at some of the crazy extremes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, closing schools, closing universities, doing this, doing that. I get the feeling a lot of people do this to protect themselves against charges later, but we should not panic, because in the panic we can hurt a lot of people.
Well, here in the Dallas area, and I assume it's the same in other parts of the country, you have shortages of like hand sanitizer, these bottles, and even toilet paper and stuff like that. But people are, overreacting and they're buying all these things. But I have to say that I feel that once President Trump put Vice President Pence in charge of this, at least in charge of the communications, to me that was a great improvement, because sometimes President Trump in his excitement, let me put it that way, in his excitement can say things. And whereas I think Pence, I saw Pence over the weekend several times.
Yes.
And I just think he's a lot more, he's got that calm personality, has tremendous credibility.
Pence is right out of Central Casting as a president.
I agree. I agree with
you.
If you
have his personality and Trump's drive, you'd have some president.
Well, that's right, and I think they make a great team together. I keep saying that the Trump administration has three great people, if I could put it that way. Pompeo as Secretary of State, obviously the Attorney General Barr, and Vice President Pence. I think these are the three most important people that he has, and if he were to lose any of those three for whatever reason, I think it would be a huge loss for his administration. But I just love the way Pence is handling this. But you were sharing some statistics and Urgent Agenda here in the last couple of days, comparing past experiences, flu and other things in the past that were far more deadly than this, and yet the media tends to, well, I'm not going to say all of the media, but some of the media has become pretty irresponsible, Bill.
Well, you know, it's a story that's good for business, as they say. Everybody wants to know about it. Everyone wants to protect their children. And, of course, we should. I mean, nobody wants anybody to get this. But at the same time, there are some journalists who've put it into perspective. I mean, we had the 1918 flu epidemic that killed thousands and thousands of people. They were stockpiling coffins. We had, of course, the unspeakable polio epidemics, which thank goodness were brought to an end by Jonas Salk and his vaccine. But I mean, there you had real horrible tragedies, one after the other, and of course the regular flu epidemics that we have every season, and the vaccine has changed to accommodate new strains. And yet many people are very lax about getting their flu shots, thinking that this virus is a much larger problem. No, it isn't. The flu is the much larger problem.
Mm-hmm. That's right. No, I think you're right. I think, 64,000 people every year die because of the flu. And I know certain age groups automatically have to get the flu shot. And so, yes, I agree. And I think there is some hype. But I have to say that I have not seen CNN here recently in the last few days. And that might be a good thing. But I understand that for a while there, they were really going really nutty on the virus. But I don't know if they're still doing it, Bill. I don't know if you've had a chance. I know you watch CNN so that we don't have to. But,
yes.
But
I'm prepared
to
sacrifice myself for my country.
Yes, but that's right. You do this for all of us who follow Urgent Agenda. But I know that it seemed like a few days ago, they were really going nutty on this virus, Bill.
Well, yes. Well, some were, and of course there were the attempts, subtle sometimes, to link it to President Trump, which is what they're in business for at CNN.
Mm-hmm.
I think, for the most part, though, the press has been reasonable. What is always lacking in news stories today, because it isn't emphasized as much as it was in the past, is basic information. That's what people want to know. They want the basic information. What are my chances? If I get it, what are the symptoms? If are certain people in my family more susceptible? That's what people want to know. The actual number of deaths in the United States is unbelievably small for a country of 330 million people. That does not mean each one is not important and that we shouldn't take precautions. I don't know if there was any fault to lay at the hands of the administration. If there was, come out with it. But so far, I haven't seen anything except this problem with testing kits. That I don't understand. It hasn't really been explained. But apparently, we are very short on testing kits, and we probably should have been in better shape there. But that can be examined. But the Democrats never miss an opportunity to try to blame the president for something.
Right. No, I think you're right. And I think even in some of the other countries, where they're suffering. Iran has a very serious problem. I mean, Iran has a population of like 60 million people. So the fact that maybe 300 or 400 have died, it's still very small numbers relative to the population, Bill. In Italy, too. In Italy, I think they've had 147 deaths. But again, compared to a country of 40 or 50 million people, that's still a very, relatively small number of people, Bill.
Well, that is absolutely true, and it's something we should look at. Of course, what people will say in response is, if it's your family, it's not a small number.
Well,
and,
of course.
And that's absolutely true. So, but, they apparently, from what I've read, they hope to have a vaccine ready sometime this year. What many people don't realize is that you can't just develop the vaccine. It has to be tested not only for its potency, its ability to do the job, but to make certain that it isn't killing people. You can develop a vaccine that can do more harm than good. And I have a great deal of faith in the people in Washington who are working on this. They seem to be very, very good. We've had a good record of developing vaccines in this country. And just take reasonable precautions, but don't go crazy.
Right. Well, the gentleman who was on TV this morning, Piacci or Fiacci,
Fauci, Fauci.
He came across extremely competent to me.
Yes.
You know, well,
he's
I was
an
watching
old, he's
him.
A very, he's an old old timer in the pandemic business, the epidemic business. He he's been around before. I think he was very active in AIDS research, if I'm not mistaken. I might be mistaken. But Dr. Fauci, I think, is a name we know. And, you know, I remember back when the AIDS epidemic was first detected, people went hysterical. And, you know, AIDS is a fatal disease. There's no question about that. And the President Reagan was trashed, of course, immediately as not having you're not doing enough, you're not doing this, not doing that. And it was explained to people that there is not – When chasing a disease, there is not that much to do except try to understand it at first, and then you can go about curing it. And then good scientists eventually understood what AIDS was. I don't think they have a total cure today, but I know it can be treated in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there you have the additional issue of that it was a disease that was largely in the gay community, and they didn't want to discuss that way.
Right.
So politics began to enter into it. But the fact is that if you look at the record, as soon as they understood what it was, the president, President Reagan at the time, had no problem signing whatever checks were necessary.
Well, even today, didn't President Trump just sign a, what is it, an $8 billion package?
Yeah.
That, you know, that was out, that will contribute a great deal to doing this. I mean, I just think that people need to listen to the experts, and I think we have an excellent team of experts. And if the gentleman that was on TV this morning, if that's who these people are, I mean, he represents that group extremely well, and I felt very comfortable listening to him. He was very credible. And he seemed like a man who really knew what he was talking about, Bill. I mean, you felt like this is a politician. This is not a guy went pandering for votes. This is a guy who was giving it to us pretty straight, Bill.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I think highly respected. And that's what I think the people are looking for. And I agree. I second your comment on the vice president. His image is absolutely remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
He could be right out of a Hollywood movie and play the president.
That's right. Yeah, he has this his personality, the way he speaks and the way he answers questions. He never gets angry. He's very respectful of whoever's asking the question. I mean, he's the exact opposite of President Trump, Bill.
Exactly.
And which is why I'm so happy that it's Vice President Pence who's doing the talking, because sometimes President Trump, and you know, we love him. We think he's doing a great job. But sometimes he has to fight back everything. So if he gets a confrontational question, he will just fight back. And sometimes when he fights back, I think he says things that he probably regrets later. And whereas Pence doesn't do that. Pence doesn't take the bait. He just, you know, he talks and he answers the question, but he doesn't lose self-control. And I love that, Bill.
Well, I do too, and they should put them out there more often.
I agree. They should, and I think that hopefully they will, because he is, I think, an asset in every sense of the word. And by the way, getting into our next story about Vice President Biden, or former Vice President Biden, and the fact that he's, I think, these next couple of months, the Vice President is going to be demonstrating in many ways why he's not quite ready for this challenge. But if in fact he is the nominee, who his vice president is going to be extremely important, and that's where Pence could very well do a great job in reelecting President Trump. Debates between the nominees for vice president are going to be huge, Bill.
Well, I think that you're exactly right, and my great fear is that the Democratic Party will go the identity politics route.
Mm-hmm.
That they will, you know, that in order to, for their, in effect, to be no trouble, they will have to nominate a person who has fit certain categories. And that's not the way you choose a leader. But this is exactly the culmination of identity politics that we feared, that we'd be in a situation where we desperately need a candidate for vice president on the Democratic ticket who can step in immediately and become president. And there are
That's
very
right.
few people like that, and there are plenty of people in the Democratic Party who don't care. All they care about is what is the identity? Is it a person of color? Is it a woman who was also a person of color? Oh, that would be good. Maybe a gay woman who is also a person of color. That's the way these people think. They don't even think in terms of the issues. I mean, I hear the name Stacey Abrams being bandied about. She was the Democratic candidate for governor of Georgia who lost by 60,000 votes and tells us that the election was stolen. And this woman, the highest she has been is, I think, Speaker of the Georgia Senate or Georgia House of Representatives, one of the two bodies. And that's it. No national experience of any kind, no foreign policy experience, no major experience with big issues, no executive experience. And if they choose somebody like that, it's kind of an insult to the country.
I agree. And I think somebody like – and I think Stacey Abrams may very well be who he gets stuck with. Because
yes, he might.
If they get to the convention and you know, assuming he gets nominated, and in a minute we're going to talk about what this gentleman, I can't think of his name right now,
Michael Goodman.
He wrote an article, and you wrote about this, and we'll get to that in a minute. But let's assume that he does get the nomination. I think the Sanders people, who may very well represent 40% of the delegates or even more than that, are going to say, if you want unity, you got to put her in.
Yeah.
And that's a very real possibility, Bill.
Well, I think it is too, because we've seen they don't care about anything else. I mean, they can say, well, wait a minute, that's not true because Bernie is an old white man. But Bernie became the titular leader of that movement by actually putting himself out there. But when it comes to making choices, I mean, you look at the people around Bernie, it's frightening. Many of these are real hard leftists, many of them from the Palestinian movement.
Yes.
And I mean, every time you see another name, you say, well, what about my group? Am I represented there? Are ordinary Americans represented? Well, they're really not. I mean, it's a very extreme fringe of the Democratic Party that came awfully close and may still get the nomination. But I think that I think it was interesting today that Kamala Harris endorsed Joe Biden, who she had been attacking regularly.
I suspect
she did that because she's going for vice president.
Yeah,
now that would have to satisfy. Although apparently Kamala Harris, as a prosecutor, was involved in a controversial case.
Right.
You can't be involved in a controversial case where a person of color is involved, and that may knock her out. I mean, this is the craziness that's going on in the Democratic Party.
That's exactly right. I mean, even the lady from Minnesota, Amy Klobuchar, has had some problems with some prosecution before. The amazing thing to me, Bill, about that prosecution is, or these attacks on these former prosecutors, is that they were enforcing the law that was the law of the state at that moment.
That's right.
Whether it's
That's
Minnesota
right.
or California. I mean, that was their job. They were either prosecutor or attorney general in the case of Kamala Harris. So, I mean, what exactly do these people – don't they want the attorney general to enforce the laws of the state?
No.
I mean,
they regard the law as racist. These are people who are in a fringe of the party, many of whose members believe that the police should be abolished.
Yes.
I mean, that's how extreme this is becoming. And you have George Soros out there financing campaigns around the country. It's his project to put in district attorneys around the country who really don't believe in prosecution. And he's succeeding. The district attorney of Philadelphia is one of his products. And here in New York, where some of these very, very radical leftist procedures involving criminal justice have been inserted, the crime rate is soaring in New York City. Absolutely soaring. Up by huge numbers. And, of course, that is the reason that people are not being prosecuted or held in custody when they used to be held in custody. And, of course, they're going out and committing crimes again.
Yeah. And here's where, you know, getting back to Michael Bloomberg for a second, who, of course, was put out or decided not to run anymore after yes. Super Tuesday. But that would have been a great opportunity for Mike Bloomberg. I really believe had he stuck to his guns and say, yes, I did this, and here are the results. We cut crime. Had he done that, I just think he would have been better off. But maybe
fully
he's in
agree
the wrong party.
You.
He's in the wrong party,
not,
I think.
Yes, people do not like these apology campaigns. I
no,
apologize
don't.
For what I did. I mean, you even had a situation down in Arizona, I think it was last year, where the husband of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, you remember, she was the one
yes,
who was
yes.
shot and had
right.
to leave office. Her husband is running for the U.S. Senate. He is an astronaut. He's a brave man, military officer,
mm-hmm.
and he said something in praise of Winston Churchill, and the crazy leftists immediately denounced him because Winston Churchill was a racist, and he was
right.
a this, and he was that. He's the man who saved democracy, who made their movements possible. But
yes.
This man, this candidate, the husband of Gabrielle Giffords, he folded like a cheap suit. He immediately apologized. I said, what the hell are we doing, making people apologize for quoting Winston Churchill? I
yes.
mean, but there is within the Democratic Party, you have very, very extreme people, and they are not looking at the example that was set in Britain, where recently the Labour Party was almost destroyed because
mm-hmm.
it had gone so far to the left that regular members of the party who normally voted Labour refused to vote for them. And, the polling afterward confirmed that. The party was almost put out of business. They're trying to rebuild now. But that
mm-hmm.
could happen to the Democratic Party here. I mean, if they continue to move further and further to the left, quite obviously out of the mainstream of American life. So they're trying to put up Biden as an example of moderation. But I have a feeling that by the time the Sanders people get to him and the others get to him, he's not going to sound so moderate at the convention.
No, but he's already taking a lot of crazy positions that he before had rejected, whether it's abortion, whether it's LGBT, whether it's a lot of these other issues. he was a much different candidate. He would have been a much different candidate if he had stuck to those positions. But you're right, he was forced to go to the left. Now, let's talk a little bit about a article by Michael Goodwin that just came out, I guess, today, Sunday, at the New York Post, and it went over the it went national, I guess, in different parts of it was available in different parts of the country. That's what I'm trying to say. But this is an article where he's speculating as to what could happen to the Democrats in Milwaukee when they get there. And just to kind of set the table, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he's saying that what I believe, that Joe Biden is going to be a real problem, that he's going to start saying a lot of things. And I think he's, by the way, Bill, I think he's going to look awful next to Bernie Sanders, because Bernie Sanders is a pretty good debater.
Yeah.
He may not be right on the issues, but he's a pretty good debater. And I think he's going to throw, I really believe he's going to throw, Biden off his game. And Biden's going to say some stupid things, and it'll become very clear that the Biden we had seen during all those debates is, in fact, the Biden that is running or is leading for the nomination. So
yes.
We get to Milwaukee, the convention, the so-called superdelegates are very worried. They're concerned now about Joe Biden, whether Joe can handle this, whether he's up to it. And they take the first vote. Nobody wins. Now we get to the second vote. The superdelegates step in, and they decide to call Hillary Clinton and see if she wants to run for president, Bill. Am I right? Is that what Michael Goodwin
That's
was saying?
Pretty much, I think, what he pretty much implied. One
yeah.
thing that I think was missing in that column was a discussion of the rules of the party. I don't know if the rules of the party would allow something that blatant, or whether Biden could be prevailed upon to give his delegates to somebody else. I don't even know if that's allowed. But I think we're going to be getting into some very arcane discussions in the next few months, things that we haven't discussed since 1952, and that is the rules of the convention. And this, I think, teaches us another lesson. about presidential elections in this country. We used to have presidential elections where the parties were pretty much run by leaders, by members of Congress, by people with years of experience. We didn't like some of those people. Some of them were called boss. If they were on the Democratic side, on the Republican side, they were called organizers. But the bosses in the Democratic Party, who were legendarily powerful in big cities, you could say a lot of negative things about them, all of which would be true. But they were professionals. They took their work seriously, and it's interesting, they never went to any convention and nominated a jerk. I mean, they 90% of these people you see on a platform would never have been allowed on a platform in that era. I'm not suggesting we go back to it, but I am suggesting that we start putting a little emphasis on experience, on wisdom, on age, the things that really are necessary to run a successful political party. What we're getting in the Democratic Party today is an extension of what was called the McGovern rules. And they were basically created by George McGovern, who was the Democratic presidential candidate in 1972 and lost 49 states. But he felt more democracy was necessary in the Democratic Party. A political party is a private organization. They can have whatever rules they want. And one of the things you have to be careful of in these situations is too much democracy. The founders of this country understood that. That's why we have checks and balances in the Constitution. And the Electoral College, all of which are barriers to the mob. What you have today in the Democratic Party is a party where many people are trying to run it by mob rule, where you just come in. And we saw the beginning of this years ago. When I was in high school, we had people who were very much in love with a man named Adlai Stevenson, who was the Democratic candidate for president in both 1952 and 1956. And he spoke well. He sounded like an intellectual. Oh, he sounded so wonderful. I stood a couple of feet behind Adlai Stevenson once while he was making a speech. And he was eloquent. He really was. The problem is that an hour later, you couldn't remember what he said. Because he really didn't say anything. I mean, you know, he was basically a marshmallow, but he was an eloquent marshmallow, and these were the kind of people who liked that, and they would come in whenever the presidential election was about to be held, and they would volunteer their services. And right after the presidential election, and Stevenson losing, they would disappear, and you didn't see them for 4 years.
Right.
That is a very dangerous thing in a political party, because the party begins to be taken over by amateurs who really do not understand the mechanism of politics. And that's what you're getting in the Democratic Party today.
Right. And another, before we take a break, I also wanted to add something to what you're saying. I think another big mistake the Democrats made, and I don't know when they wrote these rules. I think you're right. It was back in the McGovern days. But to have these proportional delegates is insane. One of the things that I love about the way the Republicans do it is that we have the winner take all. So at least by May or June, you've got a pretty good idea who your nominee is. And you may not like the nominee, or you may have issues with him, as many of us did with Trump in 2016. But at least we know that we knew that he was going to be the nominee, that he was going to be winning the first round. And we could try to kind of set up for that, you know, either with a vice president or whatever. But these Democrats, the rules they have, you know, somebody it could very likely not get to the convention of majority. I mean, if Bernie starts scoring in some of these primaries, I mean, he may not get there without the, without the majority bill.
Well, it is weird. It's weirdness on top of weirdness. I mean, our whole presidential process in this country really has to be looked at very carefully. I mean, you've got back in 1960. I always use that as an example because it was really my first experience in working in a national political campaign and for a U.S. senator. And you had a group of candidates on the Democratic side, any one of whom could have stepped into the presidency the next day without missing a beat. Because they were experienced men, they were men of some wisdom and some accomplishment. Some of them were not particularly liked, like Lyndon Johnson. And ironically, of those men running, the one who was often considered by many pundits to be the least qualified was Jack Kennedy. In fact, Eleanor Roosevelt, the widow of the late President Roosevelt, actually wrote him a public letter saying, "Are you qualified?" And you know, are you ready? She said, are you ready? And yet you look at his qualifications and compare them to any of the people on the Democratic platform today, he was far more qualified. I mean, the standards have dropped, and that is one of the things you get with this kind of mob rule political party process, the McGovern rules, where every little group gets its little say, and we want our person in there, and we want a certain number of delegates who look like us. And instead of saying who is the best candidate to be president of the United States, I don't even think they go there in discussions. Now, we're going to see that tested at the Democratic convention if things go the way they appear to be going and Biden is in the lead, and we will see it tested again in the choice of a vice presidential candidate and in the writing of the party platform. I do wish that Mike Bloomberg, we talked about this before, I do wish that Mike Bloomberg, instead of running as an ordinary candidate for president, mm-hmm. had started his own party.
I agree.
Then he could have been effective.
Well, he'd still be running today if he had done that.
Yes.
And he'd still be running today and would have been actually doing quite well, I think, in let's say in comparison to the other parties. Let me take a little break, Bill, and we'll come back. We'll continue our conversation about the Democrats and a few other stories as well. We'll be right back. Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Sunday, March the 8th, talking with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. And just before we went on break, we were talking about the Democrats. Bill, I wanted to make another point about the Democrats because I think they're really out of whack. And, for example, they have a debate coming up, I guess it's next Saturday or the Saturday after, and they're already saying that they need to include this young woman, Tulsi Gabbard, Tulsi Gabbard, right? And they're saying, and maybe they should, but the problem is that this lady did not qualify. I mean, you can criticize the fact that only two white guys are running, but they were the two who got the votes. I mean, they're the two who succeeded in the system they created. So
that's
to
right.
say that you have to have a woman in there just because you have to have a woman in there, I think that's the kind of insanity that's killing the party. I mean, the fact is that she didn't qualify. I mean, she didn't
yes.
qualify. In fact, I don't think she ever got more than 1% or 2% in any contest. I mean, if you're going to make the case that she should be in the debate, I mean, Elizabeth Warren did a lot better than she did, and she didn't make
yes.
it either, though.
Well, the fact is that I've never seen a process more fair to women than the one this year. They had up on that platform at the beginning, I believe it was five women. You had Elizabeth Warren, you had Kirsten Gillibrand, you had Kamala Harris, you had Amy Klobuchar. That's four. Who am I leaving out? I'm leaving somebody
well,
out.
Well, there was the author, that lady who was the author.
Williamson,
I think it was her name.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes,
she
that's
was the
right.
author, and she was
women.
Also in there. Yeah, you're
yeah.
right. There were quite a few women running, and unfortunately for them, they didn't make the cut.
Yes.
But then when you look at, I mean, look, if I was looking at the Democrat field and I was actually looking for someone to defeat Trump, why would I want to nominate somebody who's never run anything, whether it's Elizabeth Warren, whether it's the lady from Minnesota or the lady from – even Kamala Harris didn't do a very good job as a candidate.
No,
she
did a terrible
job. So it just
job.
Seems to me that, yeah, she was pretty bad. So, I mean, it's like – I mean, I think the voters, maybe they didn't do the identity politics any favor, but they selected the people they thought were the best candidates, Bill.
Well, that's exactly what right. I mean, they couldn't have asked for a more fair process. I mean, we could argue about, you know, the amounts of money that were available to each candidate, but it's been pointed out many times, and I think it's absolutely true. You really cannot buy a presidential election. If you go back into history, there have been many extraordinarily wealthy people who've tried to be president and have failed. I remember Averell Harriman from the Harriman interests, railroad interests, and he had been governor of New York, was qualified to be president, was a diplomat. In fact, he was very qualified, but he did not, he could not wrest the nomination from Adlai Stevenson. He was actually a much better man than Stevenson, and therefore he didn't get to be president. Another one, the perfect example, was Nelson Rockefeller, who was from the Rockefeller family, and he basically tried to, you know, use his money and his experience. He was also governor of New York and was fully qualified to be president, but the people chose, the Republican Party chose other candidates. They chose Goldwater in 64 and then Nixon in subsequent elections. Rockefeller eventually did wind up as vice president, but he never got to the top, which is where he wanted to be, and all his money didn't make that much difference.
That's right. No, and in this case, you know, these ladies just didn't make the cut, and it just, I don't know, it amazes me that they keep on talking about, you know, where is the woman? Well, the women didn't make the cut. I just, as simply as that. Now, you can argue that maybe the other women should have run, but I think one of the problems with the Democrat Party of today is that most of these women are left of center, and some considerably
yes.
left of center. And that's not where the country is, Bill. I think a lot of these women would not have added that much or will not add that much to the ticket. Let's say the Biden ticket. I don't think that Kamala Harris is going to add any votes that he already doesn't have, Bill.
No, I think she's she did the endorsement, which will not do her any good in California, by the way, because in California Democratic Party, I mean, regards Joseph Stalin as a right-winger.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's the activity of that party after 9/11 was absolutely, utterly disgraceful. It really was. It was almost anti-American, and they may not like her for this because they would have much preferred Bernie Sanders. But I think what she's doing is looking to the future and hoping that she can perhaps get herself a vice presidential nomination.
Yeah.
And you know, she might. I mean, you know, if it would be very, very hard for the party. Even the most extreme nuts in the party to turn her down because she is a woman,
right.
And she's a woman of, and she's a woman of color,
and yeah.
And you know, and that's the way they think. So, you know, why not?
Well, maybe that's what it is. But maybe they're going to force themselves to pick somebody to pick people like, you know, to pick a vice president like that. But I honestly don't think that she's going to be helping. You know, the candidate a great deal, but, you know, things could change over the next few months.
Her word in the Democratic Party, because of how poor a job she did as a candidate, is not a powerful word. Now, on the other hand, Elizabeth Warren does come into the convention, at least up to now, with something like 60 delegates. Well, that could be very critical at a certain point. And she's not endorsing anybody. She's not endorsing anybody.
No, so far, yeah. Do you think that'll stay that way? Because
who knows?
I heard some rumors that the Sanders people and the Warren people were talking, and there was the possibility of an endorsement. But that's just something I heard in the media.
My gut instinct, and it's only a gut instinct, is that she will not endorse anyone until the proper moment at the convention. That she will hope for a deadlock, where her votes will count, and make, which will make her a kingpin or a queenpin within the Democratic Party.
I guess they're going to have to be very careful, Bill, this year with words like that, king and queen, because...
Oh, you can't say that.
You cannot say that at the convention this year without upsetting some group. Well, a couple of endorsements. You had Jane Fonda endorsed Bernie Sanders. That probably, I don't know, was anybody surprised about that one? I certainly
well,
was.
Well, I was surprised. I was surprised that she's still alive. I hadn't heard. I mean, Jane Fonda is probably one of the worst people. I don't think she's an evil woman. I don't think she goes out to try to do evil. She tries to do good. But she has got to be one of the stupidest people and most naive people to become a public figure. You'd think after the mess she made of herself during the Vietnam War that she would be more sensitive, for example, to crime victims, to other injustices. But she can always be counted on to support whatever is trendy this week.
Right, that's right. Yeah, well,
I want to have a week devoted to crispy bacon, and I want to hear Jane Fonda come out and say, "This is something I feel passionately about." Crispy bacon.
That's right. Well, Jane Fonda did not do herself any good when she went to the Hanoi Hilton. And I know that that's a long time ago, but there's, you know, when you do stuff like that, one thing I've learned about military families is that they don't forget stuff like that.
No, they don't.
They really don't. And I guarantee you that even though it's a long time, it's 50 years, I guarantee you that there are granddaughters of those men of the Vietnam era who still remember that.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, it's good that they do, because if you go back to the 60 election, which I referred to before, Jack Kennedy had a real problem with his father. His father had been the first head of the Securities and Exchange Commission and people appointed by Franklin Roosevelt. And when he was appointed, many of Roosevelt's allies said, "Mr. President, why are you appointing a man who is a known crook?" And he said, "Because he knows how it's done." And that was his answer. He later appointed him ambassador to Great Britain, where Joseph Kennedy, the founding father, so to speak, was taking positions that were very sympathetic to Nazi Germany. He was known to be personally a very bigoted man. And when his son ran for president in 1960, they literally hid him in a closet. He wasn't allowed out. He didn't do any interviews. He wasn't allowed to be interviewed. It was as if he never existed. And the only time we saw him publicly was at the inauguration parade for President Kennedy, where he was allowed to sit in the, you know, in the booth or wherever they call the president's position in the inaugural parade. But he had no role in the administration at all. I mean, he was worse than a controversial figure. I mean, there are people who really believe that he was siding with the enemy and that he was just a notoriously bad man.
Mm-hmm. Well, he certainly had a reputation, with women and how he made his money and all that kind of stuff. I'm sure that was I don't remember that whether that came up in the election, but that I'm sure was something I've heard about and read a great deal about. Switching to another topic, Bill. One of the stories that I believe is going to hit the fan here pretty soon is this whole question of sanctuary cities. The White House won a legal opinion about the sanctuary cities, and I'm glad they did because I think sanctuary cities are a disgrace. I really do. But this is an issue where the American people are with President Trump, because everybody understands that you cannot have a country where a city decides, well, we're going to obey this law and we're not going to obey that law. It's simply not a doable, it's not a workable system. And pretty soon you have a chaotic country if everybody was obeying one law or another law, Bill.
Well, absolutely. And what is amazing to me is that that has not already been stomped down on by some court case. I mean, I would imagine that the sanctuary city issue will eventually come to the Supreme Court. I cannot imagine them deciding in favor of sanctuary cities. I mean, you have to follow the federal law. The federal law is supreme. And these cities are not, they refuse to. They refuse to allow their police officers to cooperate with the immigration authorities. And it has resulted in people who should be deported or in jail being out on the street. It's a terrible situation, and it cannot be justified in a country of law.
No, it really cannot. And I just think that this is also politically a winning issue for President Trump. You mentioned Bill, the Supreme Court, and I just wanted to bring up Senator Schumer here, because this week there was a very ugly incident where he I think he lost it, Bill. I don't know how he did this, but it seems like he lost it. He was in front of a group of I guess pro-abortion groups or whatever, and he just lost it. I mean, he began to attack. I thought it was interesting that he only attacked Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, the two Trump appointments.
Yes.
He didn't say anything about the other three, who I think would be the other three that could literally, overturn Roe v. Wade if it came to that. But
well,
I think he lost it, Bill. I mean, I've never seen him so. Maybe you know him better than I do, being from New York. But he seemed totally out of character being that way, Bill.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up, because one thing about Chuck Schumer, there are several things about Chuck Schumer. They used to say in Washington that the shortest line in Washington was between Chuck Schumer and a television camera, because he was always very much a publicity hound. At the same time, he's an extraordinarily intelligent man. I mean, he's very well educated, he's a very hard worker, incorruptible. He really has a basically very fine reputation. But Chuck Schumer also has something else right now, and that's a problem. And it's here in New York, and her name is AOC. He is a traditionalist within the Democratic Party. He is the minority leader of the United States Senate, and he's up for re-election. And I think it's in 2 years. And there are lots of talk. There's lots of talk that AOC, that's Little Evita from the Bronx, is going to challenge him within the Democratic Party for the nomination to the U.S. Senate. It would be an extreme convulsion in the Democratic Party if the leader in the United States Senate, and basically, essentially, the highest-ranking Democrat in the country, was brought down by this young woman from the Bronx. But it could happen. It could happen. Then you really will have an uproar, and then you will have a major explosion within the Democratic Party. But he is afraid of that. And, and what he's trying to do is to appeal to that left-wing bunch in the Democratic Party, which is very powerful in New York State. They really are. And they don't like him. They want him out. And their dream, I'm sure, is that AOC will run against him for the nomination, that she will win. It being a Democratic state, she will almost certainly then win the election, and that she will become the Senate Minority Leader. A Hispanic woman, young, from New York. I mean, then the dream can be extended further. She's about 30 right now, or 31?
Right.
As soon as she reaches 35, she's eligible to be president. And there are people who talk that way. And this is, after all, a young woman who is not very accomplished or very capable in what she does. I mean, she doesn't know very much. She's bright. Everyone concedes that. This is the way these people think. And I think that Schumer knows that his days may be numbered unless he can bring these people around to his point of view. And I think he understands that if he is primaried, he has a very good chance of losing, simply on the ethnic issues.
Right. Well, we had an interesting case down here in South Texas, Bill. Speaking of that, we had an interesting case where a fellow named Cuellar, who's a pretty moderate Democrat, he represents a border. Henry Cuellar.
Yeah.
Henry Cuellar was nearly defeated. He lost 52-48. He had always won every primary before easily, and he lost 50. He won 52-48 to another one of these AOC types, and you have to sit there and if you see that, you have to look at that and you go, wow, that could happen to me. So,
yes,
you know, I'm sure that Chuck Schumer
and they're very intimidating. They're very intimidating. I mean, they threaten people. They have no respect for the party traditions. They have no respect for history. I mean, no matter what you've done, they remind me of the anti-Lyndon Johnson crowd in the Democratic Party in the 1960s. He was a man, a flawed man, to be sure, and not always the most pleasant man, but this is the man who really was responsible for the passage of the civil rights laws, a monumental a moment in American history. He was also responsible for bringing in Medicare turning the country's attention to poverty. I mean, but he didn't sound right to the northern intellectuals. They accused him of being a wheeler dealer. Can you imagine in Washington being a wheeler dealer? You're damn right he was a wheeler dealer. That's how he got the wheels moving, you know,
that's
by
right.
dealing. And yet he was forced out of office by his own party, presumably over Vietnam. But it really was, I think, a lot deeper, that he just culturally didn't sound like us. And I see this group as very, very similar. And they're dangerous. They're almost anti-American in their views. Certainly the woman out in Minnesota, Omar, has made many anti-American statements. They don't like the country. They regard the Constitution as something that ought to be thrown out. There is an element of anti-Semitism that runs through a lot of that movement, and they are very much based now in the Democratic Party. Now it turns out that in last week's mm-hmm. primaries, AOC had backed some individuals around the country who were primarying Democrats, and she lost every one of those races.
Right. Well, including the one here.
The one there. But when you look at the numbers, the numbers in many cases were sufficiently close to at least scare the party.
That's right. Well, and speaking of numbers, Bill, I wanted to say one quick thing, too, about Super Tuesday. The numbers from President Trump here in Texas and also in other states were just absolutely amazing. Trump, in a totally meaningless primary, got more votes than all the Democrats did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's got to tell you something.
Yes, and let's look at where we are. We are in March. How many months to the election? Let's see, March.
8 months.
April.
I think
May,
it's exactly 8 months.
8 months.
Today, I think.
and it's March, April, May, June, July. 4 months to the conventions. Mm-hmm. So it's coming up on us, and you know, I don't think any predictions are really in order. Because, first of all, predictions, you know, have a way of not coming true because of things that are beyond our control and events that nobody predicted. I mean, these are, you look at Trump and you look at Biden, you look at Sanders, these are three old men.
That's
and
right.
And
Sanders Trump's
is
the youngest,
already,
actually. Trump is actually
yes,
the
Trump,
youngest.
Trump is the kid. And
it's amazing.
Yes, and Trump and Sanders has already had a heart attack on the campaign trail. Biden clearly is not at his best, and you just never know what could happen. Biology can take its course, and then what do you do? And also, we don't know what the economy is going to do. I have always been suspicious. I have nothing to base this on except my own gut feeling, but that the 2008 election was in some way influenced improperly by economic forces in the society, because that economic crash we had in 2008 occurred 6 weeks before the election by some strange coincidence. And it did bring down John McCain, who was running a poor campaign anyway. But I just wonder if there are forces at work, the George Soros faction, that have access to large dollars and chunks of the economy. I don't think you can predict anything. Also, I think that the convention in Milwaukee may turn out to be a real catastrophe. I mean, I remember the 1968 Democratic Convention and what it did to the Democratic Party, and it can happen again. It really can happen again, where you have rioting in the streets, you can have physical assaults, and I don't know what even a pro-democratic press will say about it.
Right. Well, one quick thing. I wanted to go back to Michael Goodwin for a second. I think he has a very good point in that article. The one thing, though, that I think he may be overlooking, and maybe he mentioned it and I just don't remember, but I don't think that the Sanderistas or the Sanders people are going to be crazy about giving the nomination to Hillary Clinton, someone who didn't run for anything. I know they've got the votes to do it, but I don't believe they're going to be very happy with that decision. So I think that what could go wrong with that approach is that you end up turning off a lot of Democrats who at least campaigned, at least they were out there working for the nomination. And here you're handing it to somebody who didn't even run. One quick thing, Bill, before we run out of time. This is the 37th anniversary, 1983, of the second time that President Reagan referred to the Soviet Union as evil. He did it in England before the House of Commons, and then he did it before a religious group in Washington, D.C. And it's always one of my favorite moments in Reagan's presidency when he called the Soviet Union the evil empire, because people like you and me know that it was an evil empire. So I think it's good to remember that speech, and maybe they can talk about it in schools, particularly a lot of these schools where they're not really teaching history correctly, Bill.
Well, I don't even know if some of the teachers know who Ronald Reagan was. I mean, it's the teaching of history is abysmal. In fairness, it is not the first time this has happened. I remember back in the 50s, it always struck me when I was in high school that they never studied World War II. This was the war of our parents' generation. Mm-hmm. It wasn't mentioned, and I once asked the teacher about this. I said, why does American history end so early? And she was very honest about it. She said, look, many of these things that you would like to read about, like the war and the New Deal, are still very controversial, and the school mm-hmm. systems try to avoid controversy. And I mm-hmm. thought that was a very good answer. It was an honest answer.
Yeah,
Study of history is abysmal because the teachers' colleges who turn out many of the teachers who have been taken over by the far left. We have Columbia Teachers College here in New York, which has really become, you could call it the Kremlin and you wouldn't be far off.
That's right. That's right. Well, Bill, there is a one last thing here. There is a primary coming up on Tuesday night, I think this Tuesday night, in Michigan. It looks like the experts are saying that that Senator or the Vice President Biden is going to win, and that may be the case. But I just think the Sanders people are so well organized that I wouldn't discount anything. If I remember in 2016, I think that Sanders won Michigan. Remember in 2016, and he did it again by simply out organizing Hillary Clinton, Bill.
Well, I think that the Biden campaign is mostly a campaign against Sanders. I don't think too many people are enthusiastic about Joe Biden.
That's it.
But they are frightened by Bernie Sanders, and I think when Sanders started to praise Fidel Castro, they woke up to what Sanders actually stands for and what he's always stood for, and that it was mm-hmm. he was always pro-Soviet. He is a man surrounded by some very, very controversial, that's a light word for it, mm-hmm. people in the Democratic Party who tend to be on the very far left. He is a man who himself does not have much of a record, despite all his years in public office, of actually accomplishing anything. And mm-hmm. I think when they learn more and get the exact quotes, it's going to hurt more and more and more. This is a man who has really no place to go but down. I think he's reached his peak.
I agree.
And they're going to, when the Trump people start going after him, it's going to really be something to see.
Right. Well, by the time the Trump people get to him, he may not even be the nominee, because I think the strategy, my guess is that the Biden strategy is going to be to talk about all of this. I think you're going to see Biden all of a sudden start talking like a Cold War warrior, you know what I mean? He's going to start sounding, like Harry Truman or stuff like that when he's talking to with Sanders at the next debate. Well, Bill, as always, the time flies, but I want to thank you so much for your time tonight. And next week we'll have a debate as well as the Michigan primary to talk about, and
yes,
whatever else happens in this crazy political year, Bill.
And then remember that on the 17th, which is a week from Tuesday, Ohio and Florida vote.
Yes.
Now, if you set up a scenario where Biden does very well this week, that 17th figure looms large, because that could be the knockout punch against Sanders. He,
right.
Sanders cannot carry Florida. He's antagonized every group down there. I mean, he seems to go out of his way. Biden will take Florida, but then that all-important state of Ohio that comes up so often in American politics as being the state you must have, if Biden also takes Ohio, I don't know what argument Sanders has left. And
you're right. You're right about Ohio. That is it. If they can get past Ohio, then I think it's a done deal at that point. Well, Bill, thank you so much. My clock is running out, but have a wonderful day, and thank you for your time, and keep up the great work at Urgent Agenda.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Silvio, and I look forward to talking to you again Sunday.
All right. We'll do it again next week. We'll do it again next week for sure. Thank you very much. Well, that's going to do it, folks. This clock really went by fast tonight. So thank you for listening. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and we'll talk to you the next time. Bye-bye, everybody.